Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Coming up on the show, we'll take a look at why you might want to double check on whether or not you have an outstanding warrant.
It cost me some money. It cost me some stress. It cost my daughter some stress. It's kind of a snowball and it keeps going.
An owner of two coal mines in Wyoming is now bankrupt, and we'll find out why.
They were bleeding cash. It was really, really desperate situation for the company.
Thousands of coyotes are killed every year to protect livestock and big game. But does it work?
Oftentimes, coyote control programs have been implemented in some or many instances. It seems like the effects were negligible.
Those stories and much more are coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. A week has passed since one of the largest coal companies in the U.S. went bankrupt. Newly public documents help answer long-held questions about why it took Cloud Peak Energy so long to file bankruptcy and what its plans are for the future. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports.
Back in November, Cloud Peak Energy announced it would consider significant changes to its business. At the time, it was weighted down by nearly $400 million in debt and weakening coal sales. The company was open to a buyout, a sale of one or all of its coal mines, or finding a way to push back its debt. But nothing worked out. So on May 10th, Cloud Peak had no choice but to go bankrupt.
Some bankruptcies aren't really emergencies. Cloud Peak's bankruptcy really was a crisis. It was an emergency.
That's Clark Williams-Derry, Director of Energy Finance at Sightline Institute, a think tank.
They were bleeding cash. It was really, really desperate situation for the company. It looked to me as though they were going to be out of cash this May.
But before being forced to face that reality, Cloud Peak extended a critical debt payment four times.
It was pretty clear once you read the bankruptcy filings that Cloud Peak was doing everything it could to figure out how to get through its crisis.
Back in November, Cloud Peak tasked investment bank J.P. Morgan to find potential buyers. It found 21, but ended with only one proposal. It didn't pan out. Another sale process began in December. Documents also show Cloud Peak looked at debt restructuring, though that had been a long-term effort. Williams-Derry explains Cloud Peak may have had better luck with both attempts when coal markets were healthy.
These are not seen as prime assets anymore. They're not seen as takeover targets.
What really pushed Cloud Peak's timeline back was an internal dispute with debt holders on how the bankruptcy would unfold. After that, Cloud Peak voluntarily filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Bankruptcy documents also included assurances important to the state. Cloud Peak filed motions to keep employees working with normal benefits, to pay off millions in county taxes it's already missed, and pay its reclamation obligations. But Senator Michael Von Fladern in Gillette doesn't feel comforted, and neither do constituents who've called him. He's heard of Cloud Peak employees already quitting.
That you really think your job is somewhat safe if you have any seniority at all, but there has to be some that are trying to get on with one of the other coal mines.
Campbell County is very nervous. It's on the hook for millions of dollars in yet unpaid taxes from Cloud Peak, not to mention hundreds of millions of dollars in reclamation obligations. The company has a plan to pay both, but future court dates will further discuss that. Bankruptcy documents do show what Cloud Peak's next steps are. Instead of debt holders becoming the owners like some expected, they laid out an aggressive schedule to sell their assets. Cloud Peak's debt holders will try again to sell off their mines and get its money back, all by June 26. It's possible that all is not lost. Von Fladern is hopeful nearby major coal companies could take over, mainly so the state isn't stuck with reclamation or cleanup costs.
And we're hoping it's a Peabody or a Arch Coal, which probably has the bonding ability to take over the reclamation end of Cloud Peak.
You might wonder why Cloud Peak's debt holders are trying a sale again, since one attempt has already failed. But DebtWire credit analyst Michael Coleman says it could have more luck this time.
There's certain liabilities that'll be wiped away in the bankruptcy process, which would make it more advantageous now for someone like Archer Peabody to buy them.
He says that would be the best case scenario for Cloud Peak, much like Von Fladern's hope, if a big company comes in and scoops them up.
And certain synergies may be produced, which may make the mines more economical in that respect.
Questions remain on how employment and benefits will look, likely until after the auction next month. Senator Von Flatiron says he's holding his breath.
And hopefully they'll keep the jobs going and they'll find a white knight that'll ride in and buy the properties and keep at least a majority of the jobs going.
Potential buyers have to alert CloudPeak of their interest as soon as June 5th, with the possible auction on the 26th of the month. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
In Looney Tunes, Wile E. Coyote chases the Roadrunner around with a fork and knife, but his efforts always end badly. He runs off a cliff. Gets pounded by a tree. Takes a bomb to the face. But all the jokes have a side of truth. The federal government kills thousands of coyotes every year in an attempt to keep them from catching their prey. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards found out, not all wildlife biologists agree that killing is effective.
In a canyon near Rock Springs, a helicopter descends. Two coyotes are handed out, bound and blindfolded. University of Wyoming researchers place them on a mat. The animals stay calm and still. PhD student Katie Hugler oversees this study.
So we collect sex, age, weight, and a few body measurements just to get an idea of how big the coyote is, those sorts of things. But really what's most important to us is that GPS data.
And it's data on collars these coyotes will wear the rest of their lives. Around 30 coyotes are now collared, and boy, do they roam. Hugler is amazed at one young female who wandered all the way to Colorado.
It's like 110 miles as the crow flies. Turned around and came back like 3 days later. And they're moving fast, but they're also moving really far.
But Hugler says they're curious if all that roaming changes during the window when mule deer fawns are born. Mule deer numbers around the West are declining, down by 31% since 1991. And some people blame coyotes. UW Wildlife Professor Kevin Monteith says they're mapping coyote movement to see if the predators are targeting newborn fawns.
They're definitely seeking out those places, which for an opportunistic carnivore like that makes a lot of sense. These deer are given birth within a 2 to 3 week period. It's a prey item that's highly vulnerable, protein rich.
It stands to reason that maybe killing off some of the coyotes would allow more fawns to survive. But Monteith says that's not what the research necessarily shows.
Perhaps of why predator control can be a really challenging thing to do sometimes, because you may do your best to implement a control program in one area and the next day you just have an exchange of animals that come right back in and fill that place.
In fact, some studies show that if you kill off a lot of coyotes to help their prey, the coyotes breed even more, making coyotes even more of a threat.
Oftentimes, coyote control programs have been implemented, and in some or many instances, it seems like the effects were negligible.
Yet these conclusions haven't affected the high number of coyotes killed by wildlife services. That's the little-known federal program run by the U.S. Department of Agriculture that conducts such lethal control. In 2017, the agency killed over 5,600 coyotes in Wyoming, mostly to protect lambs. Nationally, they killed 68,000. But some wildlife groups are wondering why coyotes are shot, trapped, and poisoned when the science doesn't show it works.
So yes, this is something that we've been working on at a national scale, really trying to transform wildlife services.
Colette Adkins is with the Center for Biological Diversity, a wildlife group that's filed a lawsuit against wildlife services in Wyoming because they say the state's environmental assessments here are outdated.
An agency like in Wyoming, which is relying on science primarily from, 70s, the 80s, maybe the early 90s, that just isn't okay. When it's a couple decades old, they need to take another look.
And a lot of new information has come out.
And in this last decade, we really have seen this growing body of literature that points to the effectiveness of non-lethal methods. For example, using guard dogs or fencing or frightening devices.
Those are methods to protect livestock. Rod Merrill is with Wildlife Services in Wyoming. He says noisemakers and dogs do work, and Wildlife Services uses them, but the effects aren't long-lasting. As far as new data that female coyotes breed more after they're killed back, he's not convinced.
I have read those studies, and from my personal experience in the field for 23 years, I don't agree with them. The number of pups that a female is going to have is specific to genetics.
What Merrill is saying is that he's seen that lethally controlling coyotes does still work best to protect prey, whether livestock or big game.
One thing I have learned in my career is that for every study out there that proves a particular point, there's another study that refutes it.
But more and more court judges are convinced by the latest research. California, Arizona, and Idaho all are now required to change their plans to include more non-lethal approaches. In the canyon, both coyotes now sport GPS collars. Researcher Taylor Lashar teaches a classmate how they're released into the wild.
When I'm ready and you say you're ready to go, then you'll like take your hands back really fast and I'll kind of push them. They run really fast. Yeah. Like, you ready?
Yeah.
Okay.
The young male coyote springs away from their hands. He looks back for a half second, confused at his freedom, and then he's gone. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
Meep, meep.
Coming up, we will join some Native American students on a cultural trip to Yellowstone. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. Three schools on the Wind River Reservation participated in a cultural field camp just south of Yellowstone. The day camp, organized by the National Forest Service, hopes to give Eastern Shoshone and Northern Arapaho children a chance to learn their culture while outdoors. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska joined the fifth graders and has the story.
It's a sunny day on a sagebrush meadow at the Black Rock Ranger District that has a view of the Tetons and is just a couple miles from the south entrance of the Bridger-Teton National Park. Patrick Moss, of the Northern Arapaho Tribe, stands inside a circle of fifth graders from the Wind River Reservation.
Throughout the day, you all will be having a time at each of the stations, learning and sharing what you know, as well as learning of what the elders will be providing.
Moss introduces the elders that will be their teachers today. Then five fifth graders sing a flag song. This is Black Rock Field Camp, organized by the Forest Service and sponsored by many agencies like the Sierra Club and the Elk Refuge. The camp started 4 years ago just for fourth graders to learn outdoor education, but last year a second day was added for fifth graders with a focus on learning about their culture. And Joshua Mann, who is the Eastern Shoshone Historic Preservation Officer, says bringing awareness to younger kids is very important.
You know, with technology and the other, devices, it makes a lot of our kids, reliant, and, a lot of our culture is kind of fizzling away.
But he says at least his tribe is aware of this problem.
And it's, dwindling away, and that's, sad to say, but, it's one of the truths that, that we can change now.
And then Mann gets pulled away by a curious kid.
What are we going to talk about?
We're going to talk about little guy, what we do, about the ancient tribes, our people, what we used to do. So be careful with those. These are very sharp.
What's sharp is some rocks that their ancestral people who lived in this area used to make arrowheads with. All around, Eastern Shoshone and Northern Arapaho elders are now heading up different stations like archery, painting medallions, or making a beaded choker.
Okay, my name is Stanford Deviney. Middle name is Butch. I'm better known as Butch.
Butch is presiding over the storytelling station.
I just did a story on the legend of the Devil's Tower. These stories are here for the children to learn about their culture.
He says when he was growing up, he played, hunted, and fished outside with his uncles or other family members who taught him his culture.
Like nowadays, everything's modern. Getting information from the internet and to, learn to do things from the internet. And they don't go outside. Like in my day, we went outside all day.
And the kids are definitely enjoying the outdoors. A group of boys are running around playing, but stop to chat with me.
Did you learn anything, though?
No. Yes, no, yes.
I learned about
maybe.
Oh, yeah, we learned about the
chokers. Yeah, the chokers.
Yeah, the chokers.
What are they for?
Buffalo.
Under one of the yellow activity tents, I meet Kaylin Sunrhodes, a Northern Arapaho single father of two sons. The field camp is exposing the boys to things that Sunrhodes himself didn't even know.
They talked about some of the traditional medicines that are still here growing, and they were able to know that I didn't know some of the stuff that they were talking about.
Sunrhodes says seeing the kids making chokers and doing other activities seems to give them an understanding of who they are.
That little necklace that they made or something that they painted here is something to reflect on and look back on and as a little reminder of understand of that you are an Arapaho or you are a Shoshone descent, you know, and it's strong in you.
And to the elders, even such a small recognition means that the kids learn something at the Black Rock Field Camp. The hope is to eventually do an overnight camp so the kids can learn stargazing and nighttime storytelling. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Godalska.
The oral histories of the Eastern Shoshone tribe say their ancestors have lived in the Wind River Basin for time immemorial. Now, there is a history to help explore the tribe's relationship with the ecosystem of the area. Adam Hodge is an associate professor of history at Lourdes University in Ohio and author of the new book, Ecology and Ethnogenesis, an environmental history of the Wind River Shoshones, 1000 to 1868. Wyoming Public Radio's Taylor Stagner spoke with Hodge.
Can you define ethnogenesis for me?
Sure. Yeah, most simply, it is the emergence and evolution of distinct social cultural groups over time and space.
Why is it important to use ethnogenesis when looking at native cultures, especially pre-contact?
I think it's really, ethnogenesis, I think, is really important to look at, not just for native cultures, but for any culture, really. I think it's important to, better understand where you're at and where you're going. I think you got to know where you come from. And I think specifically, you know, the emphasis on environment is a huge piece, especially in today's day and age where so many of our, you know, challenges and opportunities, although at times it seems more like it's challenges than anything else, have a huge environmental piece. The environment is a huge piece of that process that defines people. Of course, there, you know, you don't want to verge onto the side of environmental determinism where, you know, it's just the environment acting on people and putting limitations on it. There's certainly a piece of that, but there is, of course, the human agency side as well, where there is this back and forth sort of relationship. And that's really why I emphasize ecology is people part of something bigger. They affect it. It affects them. So really emphasizing that ethnogenesis piece, I think, gets at a core piece of not just the native experience, but it's a core piece of the human experience.
I really liked in your book how you focus a lot on pre-contact. Can you tell me a little bit about your decision-making process for that?
I really value the quote-unquote pre-contact past because I think it's something that historians have generally overlooked as far as the sources, as far as the materials go. It doesn't fall very much into the traditional historian's craft of written documentation, especially when you start to talk about the environmental piece. That opens up whole new opportunities for looking at people such as tree ring studies and things like that that give some level of, a deeper level of understanding of that distant past where a lot of that has been, you know, the province of archaeologists, you know, anthropologists maybe getting through oral traditions, things like that. I think it's really important for historians to not be so tentative in looking at that past, because if we just focus on a post-contact past, well, what shaped the indigenous cultures that Lewis and Clark, that others interacted with in the early 19th century, if you want to go back to the French fur traders, you know, in the late 18th century, whatever, that there needs to be a broader historical context. And I think when you ignore or downplay the pre-contact past, where you have like a chapter that gets us up to Lewis and Clark, it does a disservice to it, and you have an idea or this misconception that well, Native Americans were here, things were great to have this. Well, they were just sort of hanging around waiting for something to happen. That's a total fallacy. And nobody necessarily portrays it as such, especially today. But I think that when you neglect the pre-contact pass, that is sort of the message that comes across.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree. Why do you think oral traditions from tribes become dismissed in quote-unquote hard sciences or a history? Or what do you think?
I think there is, in terms of, you know, okay, what animals or animal figures are present in these? What landscapes are sort of described? Or what values do they impart? I think it's a matter of, if you're looking at those as an academic and you're looking, you know, you're trying to glean certain types of information or certain insights from it, it can be wholly useful. But I think there's this broader tendency of, well, if parts of it are unreliable or parts of it might have been changed or evolved over time, then it's totally unreliable and useless. And I disagree with that, because you can make arguments about any historical document, whether it is bias, whether it is completeness, whether it is a certain perspective, or if there's an agenda in place. So to argue, you know, that there are too many weaknesses, if you will, with oral traditions is just, that's automatically dismissing a trove context and understanding for how people live.
How did you become interested in specifically the Eastern Shoshone tribe?
Travel when I was younger, family trips, you know, and one of the areas we went through was Wind River Canyon. But then when I started to get into my graduate studies, and I was researching a smallpox epidemic in the late 18th century, and one of the groups that came up that was deeply impacted by that epidemic was the Eastern Shoshone. A lot of the stuff on Eastern Shoshone history a lot of it's really dated, like 1950s and earlier. And there was a broader sense on my part of marginalization in American history of the Eastern Shoshone. I felt that there was a bigger role here in that past that needed to be brought out. I really grew to appreciate, and I hope this is something that comes through in the book, the lay of the land, just the ecological diversity and the richness of resources, connecting as much as possible with that past, talking to the people, getting your feet on the ground. And sometimes I think history can be a little abstract in that it is divorced from the past that, you know, it's about. So it was absolutely phenomenal.
That was Adam Hodge, the author of Ecology and Ethnogenesis, An Environmental History of the Wind River Shoshones. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Taylor Stagner.
When we come back, we will revisit the topic of prison overcrowding and learn about the world of outstanding warrants. This is Open Spaces. You are listening to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. According to new statistics from the Department of Justice, the country's incarceration rate is continuing to decline. From 2007 to 2017, the U.S. prison and jail population decreased by more than 10%. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler explores how that's not the case in Wyoming.
The Bureau of Justice Statistics released its report in late April and said between 2016 and 2017, there was about a 1% decline in inmate population across the U.S. And that's good news for most places, except Wyoming, who saw a 4% increase during the same time period. And that's a trend the Wyoming Department of Corrections has been noticing for years.
If you look at the trend line we have from 08 to 18 and projected to 2023, it's a steadily climbing trend line.
Steve Lindley is the deputy director for the Wyoming DOC. He says from 2008 to 2018, Wyoming's prison population grew by 21%, or about 2% each year. Lindley says that growth has put a lot of strain on the system and the state budget.
And it clearly is a drain on a state's resources, and particularly with Wyoming facing a number of statewide budget challenges that have been ongoing for a few years, it's even more pertinent.
That's so much growth, the DOC has had to get creative with where they place inmates. Anywhere from around 45 to 60 inmates stay in county jails, where the state pays counties for the space, which can get costly. The DOC also has to send inmates out of state because of the lack of space. There are 29 inmates in Scottsbluff, Nebraska, and in April 2018, 88 Wyoming inmates were transported to a private prison in Tutwiler, Mississippi. Lindley says a lot of things contributed to sending the inmates to Mississippi, like ongoing construction and staffing issues at the state penitentiary in Rawlins.
And then thirdly, taking those two things into account, then the system, the other three male facilities, they were full too. So there really was very little leeway in other facilities.
Lindley says having the inmates out of state can affect their relationships with the inmates' families and other important people in their lives.
It clearly impacts that when they're out of state, and particularly out of state a long way away. And so it's not an ideal option by any means.
Rachel is a retired school teacher, and she's been writing to an inmate since 2014 who was in Rawlins. I'm using a different name to protect her privacy.
I really got to know this person from their letters that we've written. I have packets of letters, huge packets, that we wrote back and forth for the last 5 years.
Rachel says she's been told of the differences in prison life while he's been incarcerated in Mississippi.
We've written a lot fewer letters, and that's mainly because he's working. And before, he was studying and writing and had a computer to work on. And so it's not as frequent, but I think it's still honest.
Rachel says the relationship she's built with the inmate is important to him, and she's been able to confront him with hard questions about his past and crimes. And he's been able to share his struggles too, which includes his time in the justice system.
But I'm also becoming concerned not just about this person, but about the whole system and the lengthy sentences that you give people.
The problems are something the DOC is aware of too. Deputy Director Lindley says it's been an ongoing conversation with policymakers to get something done. And during this past legislative session, lawmakers passed four bills, but one in particular may be able to help those who violate probation or parole get rehabilitation instead of a lengthy sentence.
And allows the department and the courts and the parole board some additional responses short of fully reincarcerating the person.
These are options like getting substance use or mental health treatment while being in community correction centers. Lindley says once the laws go into effect in July, it'll be a test to see if these steps will actually improve numbers. And if they don't, officials predict the prison population will grow an additional 9% by 2023. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Catherine Wheeler in Gillette.
A much more concerted effort is underway to abolish the death penalty in Wyoming. The League of Women Voters, religious groups, the Wyoming ACLU, and Wyoming's chapter of the NAACP have organized a campaign after an effort to abolish capital punishment failed in the state Senate this year after passing in the House. Sabrina King of Wyoming's ACLU is leading the nine-month campaign to gain support for the effort.
I think that there is an idea that because we haven't had anyone who has been executed since 1992, that we're really judicious with the death penalty, it doesn't cost us anything. And the reality is that even though we haven't executed anyone, every time there's a death penalty case, it costs us hundreds of thousands of dollars. Our legislature is appropriating literally millions of dollars just because a prosecutor might say, I think this is a death penalty case, and then it needs to be defended as such. And it costs so much money. And the reality is, it is not a punishment that we can even follow through with. So it's a little bit disingenuous for us, I think, to at this point have the death penalty as part of our criminal justice system.
I covered the Mark Hopkinson execution back in 1992, and I know this was an argument at the time that if you execute somebody, the cost to the state is quite a bit more, isn't it, than life imprisonment?
Yes, and the Department of Corrections has been really clear that they are capable of housing people for a life without parole sentence and doing so safely. And because of how much the public defense costs, because of how much the prosecution costs, because of how much, you know, all of the appeals cost and the cost of actually going through with an execution, all of that combined ends up costing more than simply having someone in prison for life. So if you're looking at the death penalty from a fiscal responsibility standpoint, it really doesn't make any sense.
Sabrina King visiting with us from the ACLU. She is the director of campaigns. This current campaign is to abolish the death penalty in the state of Wyoming. One of the things that I think you should probably address is some of the concerns on the other side. You've got the Prosecutors Association that actually opposed the abolishment of the death penalty. The feeling is that this is something perhaps you could use to deter crime.
There is not a single person who is involved in our criminal justice system or prosecutors who really believes that the death penalty serves as a deterrent. There has been so much that has been studied. There is so much evidence that shows that is not the case. And if you even just look at the lay of the land around the country, states that don't have the death penalty don't have hugely higher, you know, murder rates. Is actually the opposite. States that have the death penalty actually have higher death rates. So there's no correlation between whether or not you have the death penalty and what the crime rate looks like.
One thing, though, I assume is probably true is that if I'm facing my sentence or I'm about ready to, you know, if you plead guilty, you don't get the death penalty and you'll get life imprisonment. I'm assuming that's really what they're concerned about, is losing that little leverage.
Right. And there is the argument that it's a tool in the toolbox and prosecutors need it, you know, for leverage. You know, but I had a conversation with a lobbyist for the Prosecutors Association as we were going through this, and he said, no prosecutor uses the death penalty in that way. You know, and I think from an ethical standpoint, if you are a prosecutor, using the death penalty as leverage to get someone to plead guilty, I think is something that, you know, an ethical prosecutor wouldn't do, because you're basically threatening someone with death in order to get them to plead. And who knows if that person is actually guilty or not. But if you threaten someone's life, then certainly you might be more inclined to say, oh, I'll just plead guilty, because if I don't, then I'll die.
I think the fact, though, it does remain that you have enough citizens out there that like the death penalty and like it to be used. And that's maybe that last bunch, you're going to have to change some minds.
Yeah. And I think that's one piece of where we're really trying to get to over the course of the next, you know, 8 or 9 or 10 months in the lead up to the next legislative session, is having that public discussion. Because I think there are a lot of people who, you know, because we haven't had an execution since 1992, haven't really spent a lot of time thinking about it. And what we saw at the legislature is legislators who really had to sort of sit down and grapple with whether or not to keep the death penalty, many of them changed their mind and really came around to, if you look at the facts, if you look at the data, if you look at the cost, if you look at what it does to communities and to our criminal justice system, this isn't something that we want to keep on the books. And I don't think the Wyoming public is all that different. I think if we actually have that public discussion and sit down and lay out the reality of what having the death penalty means for our state, a lot of people really kind of come around to, actually, we don't need this.
What do you think it means for the state to have it?
I think it means that we are saying as a state that we are comfortable allowing our government to kill a person, which I, on a personal level, I'm not comfortable with. I don't think that's a role the government should play. And I think really when you step back and look at what the criminal justice system is supposed to be doing, retribution is not supposed to be one of those things. And that is really, at the end of the day, what the death penalty is it's retribution. The conversation at its core is about what people in Wyoming feel is justice and what is just. And my sense, especially after hearing the conversation on the floor of the House and the floor of the Senate this past year, is what is just in Wyoming is not the government executing people.
Sabrina King is with the ACLU. She's the director of campaigns. A pleasure having you back. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Police officers are expected to uphold the law, but what the law requires isn't always clear-cut. For example, how law enforcement agencies interpret legal documents like warrants varies across the state. And what officers decide to do can have serious consequences. Wyoming Public Radio's Tennessee Watson witnessed one of those situations.
I'm on a ride along with Albany County Sheriff's Deputy Jeremy Houston, We're rolling down a dirt road on the north side of Laramie, headed towards a spot where kids go to smoke pot after school. And sure enough, there's a little Toyota sedan parked just off the road, full of puffy white smoke. Houston parks, calls in his location to the dispatcher, and jumps out to check out what's going on, leaving me and his police dog behind in the truck. He chats with the three kids in the car for a bit. When backup arrives, he asks them to exit the vehicle so he can search them and the car, and he comes back to give me an update.
So he had a pipe, and the green container was full of marijuana, and she had a pipe in the back.
The two with weed on them are 18 and 19. They'll get citations for possession of a controlled substance. The third kid had nothing on her, so no charge. But because she's only 15, Houston has to release her to a parent or guardian. And it's when her mom shows up that things get interesting.
Oh, Jesus. Mom's got a warrant.
In case you didn't catch that, Houston says, Mom's got a warrant. What happens next baffles me. I watch out the front windshield as Houston hands citations to the 18 and 19-year-old, and those two, who are probably high, get to drive away. While at the passenger window, I watch tears stream down the cheeks of the 15-year-old girl as her mom gets cuffed and loaded into the second deputy's vehicle for a ride to the county jail. Luckily, her older brother came along with her mom, so she has a ride home. As we drive away from the scene, Houston explains what just happened.
So mom went to jail on a failure to pay warrant on a no insurance charge.
No insurance while driving?
Yeah.
Okay.
She owed a $455 fine for driving without insurance, so the court had a warrant out for her arrest. And in Albany County, Houston says there's no way around that.
So a lot of jurisdictions, traffic warrants, the officers that are on scene have discretion on whether or not they want to release them or arrest them, but not our jurisdiction. Just one second.
If he responds to a victim of a crime who has an outstanding warrant, Houston says he'd have to arrest that person too. Farron Babbitt is the executive director of the Albany County Safe Project. She works with survivors of sexual assault and domestic violence, and she's watched clients be arrested at her shelter.
My experience has been that many times people don't realize that they have a warrant because it was maybe something really minor or something that in all of her trauma and in all of her chaos, she didn't remember or know about, and then she was arrested.
She says officers are generally kind and compassionate, but it can still impact a survivor's willingness to work with the criminal justice system in the future.
And then perpetrators are not held accountable.
Albany County Undersheriff Josh DeBree says that's unfortunate, but that's the way it is.
They have a warrant that was issued by the courts. It's not our decision to do something or not do something with it. So, you know, we're going to take care of it.
DeBree says jailing folks who already owe fines ends up costing the county money. But some say there's another way to handle warrants for those who don't pose a threat to public safety. Levi Dominguez is the patrol lieutenant for the Sheridan County Sheriff's Office. He says warrants do command arrest, but the state statute says otherwise.
It says a peace officer may arrest a person when the officer has a warrant commanding that person to be arrested.
Dominguez says the word may is what gives officers the authority to take in the whole picture when doing an arrest on a warrant. Like if an officer pulls a parent over with three or four kids in the car for a taillight violation and discovers an outstanding failure to pay warrant.
Something that isn't a threat to the community, I guess. So at that point, is it in the best interest of everybody to arrest that person, or is it saying, hey, you have a failure to pay warrant, you know, it's a $100 fine on a speeding ticket. Why don't you go in and get that taken care of?
Dominguez says in Sheridan County, they also call to alert people that they have outstanding warrants.
The community looks at us in a different way if we're calling them and talking to them about that versus arresting them right away.
Albany County doesn't call. It used to mail out postcards with warrant information, but Undersheriff Josh DeBree says it was a lot of work without great results. As for the mom who was arrested picking up her daughter, she says she didn't know about the warrant. I'm not using her name to protect her daughter's privacy. She says that night in jail only made it harder to pay the outstanding fine because the next morning she missed 2 hours of work.
So, yeah, it cost me some money. It cost me some stress. It cost my daughter some stress. It cost, you know, her going to school the next day and not being 100% because of everything that had happened. It's kind of a snowball and it keeps going.
She admits none of this would have happened had she paid her car insurance. But she says law enforcement also has a choice to help make a situation better or make it worse. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Tennessee Watson.
When we come back, we will wrap up the program with a bike ride. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. A new United Nations report compiled from scientific data across the globe predicts that if unchecked, man-made climate change could cost around 1 million species their very existences. That caught the attention of Democrats and Republicans, but as correspondent Matt Laszlo reports from Washington, that doesn't mean Wyoming lawmakers are changing their tunes.
The UN warning is dire. Scientists across the globe now say climate change could reshape the very planet that we inhabit. And if we lose one plant or animal species, it causes ripple effects up and down the food chain. That new report was greeted with crickets from the Trump White House. But while hopping the tram under the Capitol, Wyoming Senator John Barrasso said it caught his attention.
Well, I thought it was an important report.
Just a few years back, Barrasso was denying humanity's role in the globe's rapidly rising temperatures. But he recently came around to agreeing with the scientific consensus that climate change is in fact spurred on by humans. And while he says he cares about the preservation of species of all kinds, Barrasso pushed a proposal to overhaul the Endangered Species Act that the Union of Concerned Scientists says would fundamentally weaken the act. And even in light of this new UN report, Barrasso says he stands by that proposal that critics say would gut the act by giving local officials veto authority over federal regulations intended to protect species.
In about 98 or 99% of all counties, there is a species on the list that is interfering with commerce.
That's why Democrats remain dubious of Barrasso and other Republicans who say they've been converted and now see the scientific light surrounding climate change. And freshman New York Democrat Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is skeptical.
I think one of the issues here is that I think what it is we have to be careful on if they're actually moderating their position or if they're just updating an existing position of climate denial to climate delay.
Ocasio-Cortez is pushing the Green New Deal that envisions an American economy in the coming decades that's run 100% on renewable energy. She says while Barrasso and a few other Republicans are now changing their tunes, they're not changing their actions.
The actual problem is that since it's so politically toxic right now to say I don't believe in climate change as they've been doing for 10 years, now all of a sudden they're changing their position on a dime and they're saying, oh, well, I believe in climate change, but I think that we need to have solutions on a 50 or 100-year time scale, which is not that much different than denying the severity and the actual issue at hand.
While Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney wasn't made available for an interview, last year she supported legislation to help streamline the Endangered Species Act, or ESA, and she spoke in favor of it on the House floor.
In my home state of Wyoming, Mr. Speaker, we are far too familiar with the abuses of the Endangered Species Act. The goal of the ESA should be to recover species, not place restrictive and unnecessary burdens and protections on threatened and endangered species into perpetuity.
Like Barrasso, Cheney says she supports overhauling the Endangered Species Act, and that has Democrats' heads spinning. Rhode Island Democrat Sheldon Whitehouse serves on the Environment Committee that Barrasso chairs, and he says top Republicans like Barrasso remain bought and paid for by the nation's top polluters from the oil and gas industries.
They remain entirely in the thrall of the fossil fuel industry and its climate denial apparatus. It's so in their crooked appointments to executive positions. It's so in the litigation positions they take. And it's so, unfortunately, in the reason they've abandoned leadership in the international community on this issue.
Barrasso brushes aside those charges. He says last year he helped pass the WILD Act, a bipartisan bill that was signed into law that established prize competitions to prevent illegal poaching and trafficking, manage invasives, promote conservation, and protect endangered wildlife.
So there's a lot of work that we are doing and need to do more.
And Barrasso isn't done there. He wants to update the Endangered Species Act as soon as possible so that scientists in Washington can't tell local and regional officials how to best protect endangered animals.
And we just need to modernize this in a way that you can say, if a species goes on the list, what's the recovery plan? What's the way to get that species back and then get it off the list? Because right now we have a system where something gets on the list and there may not be a recovery plan in place. It's like putting someone in the intensive care unit without a plan to heal and get better and go home.
Democrats counter that the entire planet is in the intensive care unit, and they can't understand why Republicans like Barrasso and Cheney won't even help tie a tourniquet. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
It's no secret that in peak season, Yellowstone National Park is getting really, really crowded these days. Standstill traffic, limited parking, and long bathroom lines are becoming the norm. But there's one little-known way to experience the park that offers a rare private glimpse. It's by bicycle, before the roads open to motorized vehicles, and just as the snowpack is starting to melt. Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen gave it a go.
It's about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and I'm pulling into the south entrance of Yellowstone National Park in my Subaru. In the summer, this spot can be a total zoo. Today, there are only a few parked cars and nobody to be seen. That's not the sounds of a real wolf. It's Yellowstone's AM radio playing on my car stereo.
Hello, and welcome to winter in Yellowstone National Park.
During this time of year, services within the park are shut down. That means very few, if any, rangers or park employees around to answer questions. So this broadcast plays at each of the park's entrances to let us know the rules and how to keep ourselves safe.
Roads start reopening to automobiles in late April.
The road here at the south entrance is still closed to cars. A locked metal gate keeps cars from going any further. As I get ready to hop on my bike, Michelle Chang and her boyfriend pull into the parking lot. They both live in Jackson.
To be able to ride in the park without all the cars and before all the tourists come in, it's a great opportunity to get out there on the road bikes.
Chang plans to ride the 44-mile round trip to West Thumb and back today.
So what are you packing with you on the trail? Obviously water, I'm guessing sunscreen. What else are we talking about?
Yeah, we have all the essentials to make sure that if anything happens to the bike, so spare tubes and, you know, inflators for the tires.
Plenty of snacks to keep their energy up.
And a bunch of layers because, you know, we are still in that springtime condition, so it could get pretty cold.
And maybe the most important thing, bear spray. Black bears and grizzlies are active this time of year. Chang wouldn't mind seeing one.
But not too close. Would be great. I don't know if I can outride them on even my road bike.
I agree. I already spotted two grizzlies this morning on my drive through Grand Teton. It was exciting from the relative safety of my car. On my bike, not so much. Chang and I bid each other happy trails, and I checked the forecast one last time, just to be sure. Partly sunny with a high of 55. So I hit the road.
A little bit of that lovely Wyoming wind, of course.
The road is dry and completely plowed, and it's flanked by pine trees.
Snow is like 15 feet tall right here.
A note here for anybody out there who wants to give this a try. There's a bit of downhill, but it's mostly up.
The hill never ends.
About a mile in, the road crosses Spiria Creek. It's a wide and shallow stream of water, just the kind of place you'd see wildlife. But no such luck today, so I keep riding. When I get to the top of the first major climb, I stop for a snack and some water. I tuck into some jerky, Baby Bell cheese, and fruit snacks as I look over the view. Lewis River snakes through the valley, and looking back down the road, I can see a distant glimpse of snow-capped Tetons. But what really strikes me is how quiet it is. It feels like I have Yellowstone National Park completely to myself. I bike a few more miles before I decide to turn around. It's a nice change to coast downhill for most of the ride back. In the parking lot, I run into some other cyclists that just wrapped up their ride. Like me, they didn't see anyone else on the road. Jeff Hewitt is from Jackson. He's surprised there aren't more people around.
Because it's the last weekend, I thought there'd be more cyclists as well. It's not as nice today. It was forecast to be more sunny, but it was still beautiful.
Hewitt says it's the best way to experience the park, but not a lot of people know about it.
They don't publicize this, and it's hard to find out if it's open.
Updated road information is available on the website, but it can be tricky to navigate. And taking in the park by bike attracts a specific kind of visitor, one that doesn't mind cardio or cooler temperatures.
We come out here every year and we try to do this, and it's really a treat.
I agree. I'm tired after a great day and really looking forward to indulging in a slice of pie a la mode in the next town. I didn't see as much wildlife as I expected, but as I drive away from the park, I see some more grizzlies, three this time. It's from the safety of my Subaru again, making it the perfect end to my visit. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
Thanks for joining us for Open Spaces. You can find the entire program either on our website or via podcast. Individual segments can also be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Just click on Open Spaces, and a rater is our web editor.
If you enjoy this program and our Wyoming news coverage, please support the station with your pledge on our website. Just click the Pledge Now button. We also enjoy feedback on the program and would love to hear your story ideas.
Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.